This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by two One Heat Minute Productions. The first, Ingram Advice, 45 episodes, deep diving on Paul Thomas Anderson's 2014 masterpiece based off Thomas Pynchon's novel Inherent Vice called Ingram Advice, hosted by Travis Woods, produced by myself, Blake Howard, and narrated by the awesome Kat Corbett, takes a myriad of unbelievable guests through this sort of stoner noir masterpiece. Megan Abbott, Jordan Harper, Drew McWeeny, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, Walter Chaw, Karina Longworth, Ryan Johnson, get listening. And if you're into fiction, it came from the deep. Maria Lewis, the host of our Josie and the Podcast podcast, is here with her very own audiobook, It Came From the Deep, and an after show co-hosted by myself. That's in its own feed. It Came From the Deep, Ingram Advice, search them wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's get to it.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We do need a woman president, though. Oh, my fucking... I know that for a fact because of the way that I love movies. I love movies. Any movie that you love, chances are it was directed by a man, edited by a woman, which means a woman directed it. That's what that means. Literally, name a movie. I'm serious. Star Wars, Pulp Fiction, Jaws, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, Lawrence of Arabia. It's a dude with his camera dick just pointing it everywhere, just shooting fucking film. Oh my God, just 18 miles of it. Look at this fucking, every frame is a painting. Oh my God, I'm making the masterpiece. Oh, fuck, I'm done. Yeah. Oh, fuck, I shot a lot of film. Oh, man. See all that film I shot? Holy shit. Shot film everywhere, man. I'm a genius. It's all me. Did it myself. Woo! The woman's got to show up. We all done, sweetie? Okay. Out you go. I got to make a story out of this mess. No, we're not gonna release an 18-hour movie, sweetie. No. Thank you. I got to find the story here.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. It's the 132nd episode of this show, the 132nd minute of Robert Redford and Alan J. Pakula's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. And this is the podcast that unpacks it minute by minute. And when you have a climax of a movie building and you have these monumental minutes to tackle, you need guests that can live up to the monument of that minute. And this is a person who I'm a big fan of. I've listened to and read her work extensively. She just happens to be good buddies with my best mate, Maria Lewis, who's been on the show a number of times. In fact, I lost this person's email address according to Maria Lewis. I think it's a lie. It's much like the confusion of sources that is happening in the very minute in question. This person is the editor at large, Empire Magazine. They are a soon-to-be author of a book called Women Versus Hollywood in February 21, which is the fall and rise of women. And look, I'm just absolutely thrilled to have just another, basically one of the titans of this dying industry who is still left kicking goals. Helen O'Hara, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes. Welcome.
Thank you for that intro, which is going to be impossible to live up to, but I'll do my best. but yeah, no, this is, I cannot believe you have made it this far through this film. That is an astonishing achievement, genuinely astonishing.
Well, thank you for that. And this year has been crazy. Some people have gone to work on themselves and I've gone to work on this movie. I've ignored everything on myself. Just like, go to work on this movie. And I never thought that this movie would be done. I had sort of aspirationally thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I sort of charted originally from like November of last year to January of this year, kind of, you know, that's a pretty brisk pace, but a pace nonetheless to set. And in the midst of this, I thought, no, once the American election is over, I was aiming for my daughter's birthday, which I'm going to just slightly miss, but I'm like, I just want it to, I think everyone doesn't want to talk about American politics anymore, especially someone such as yourself in the UK and myself here in Australia. It's like, you know, there's so much that's going on. It's occupied the conversation. I feel like this show's done a great, it's been my journey to go through it and have it out and also talk about art and what it matters. But I think I'm ready to sidestep, and I'll show you what is constantly on my desk at the moment. I'm ready to sidestep into serial killers in San Francisco in a different time of my of the world, basically. So
okay,
I'm interested in doing that. But look, thank you so much for, you know, you've got a huge podcast and a huge podcast schedule, and I appreciate that you guys are here. But you know, I usually have to ask people what their relationship is with this movie. And I don't really know what yours is, but knowing the topic, especially of your upcoming book and how insanely well-researched you are, I'm really extra curious. What's your relationship with New Hollywood, especially in the context of women and this movie? Is this a movie that's part of your sort of movie lexicon, something you revisit?
It's a little bit. I obviously watched it again for this, and I think that's only my third time. It might be my fourth, but it's not much more than that. Because I watched it back in the day, because of course it's All the President's Men. You should have seen All the President's Men. So when I was kind of, you know, getting into movies as opposed to just watching everything I could in the cinema, it was sort of one of the ones on my list. So I kind of saw it then. I definitely went back and rewatched it when Spotlight came out, because I just wanted to kind of compare and contrast in my own mind. And then obviously most recently. So it's at least three times, possibly four. I think there might have been another one in there somewhere. It didn't come up a lot in the book. I think there might be, it was definitely mentioned in a couple of my sources, but you know, it's one of these great movies with no women in it, really. I mean, there are a couple of great scenes with women, and there's a couple of significant female roles, but like not significant female.
I would just say this is a sausage fest of a movie. Like they can't, it's undeniable. I think the women play arguably some of the most pivotal roles. Jane Alexander's bookkeeper, for example, you know, Lindsay Krause's Kay Eddy and Penny Fuller's Sally Aitken. There's some like female characters in this movie who, I don't know, like, I don't know whether your brain tricks you. And I would totally say that this is a possibility, is when you are so engrossed in a movie, characters make a huge impact on you, and they might be just a fleeting character for someone who's a passive viewer. But for me, I go like, have you seen Lindsay Krause in this movie? Like I could watch her all day, or Jane Alexander and her pivotal scene. So yeah, I don't know, but I just mean really like New Hollywood as a time.
Yeah.
As a time of reclamation. I think another big podcast that we would both be familiar with is like Karina Longworth's podcast.
Yeah.
You know, as a time of reclaiming the idea of, you know, raging bulls and easy riders, etc. And this whole revisionist, I guess, not revisionist, but just an alternate, you know, new voices are actually commentating on that time. So well, it's really interesting.
Yeah, this is it. So I actually have to confess, I've stopped listening to You Must Remember This while I was working on this book, just because I thought, look, I'm gonna draw the entire thing from that show. Like I can't listen to it. It'll influence me too much. So I haven't listened to the Polly Platts series yet, because for exactly that reason.
Of course. Of course.
And I cannot wait. I'm really looking forward to it. But I mean, the thing is, the New Hollywood only went so far. And this is actually a sort of a chapter in my book, because I've kind of tried to go era by era through Hollywood history and kind of look at, there were women in the silent era, and they were directors and producers and editors and like everything. Women were doing everything because there were no rules that said they couldn't, right? Yes. And then when the studio system kind of began, and this is before sound came in, it wasn't sound that killed women, it was the studios and the money. Then it was suddenly a proper industry. It was a serious business. And then women were kind of just gradually pushed out. So during the entire studio era, from the sort of 1920, let's say four, until about 1960, there were basically two women making any kind of budget film. Oh my God. Right? Two. There was Dorothy Arzner in the 30s and 40s, and then Ida Lupino in the 50s. She was still technically in the DGA, but like she'd retired essentially from movies and was working in TV. And this is what's interesting about the New Hollywood. They were on the hunt for all of these new voices. They were absolutely open to new ideas. They were, you know, letting these young men break down the doors and make extraordinary things. There were women there too. There were women trying to do the same thing. There were women who had made independent films, who had screened, that had screened in Cannes, they'd screened in Venice, they'd had success. And they went to the studio chiefs, these same visionary guys who were giving these untried men money. And they were told, look, you haven't waited in line. You haven't done your time. You need to build up to this.
You haven't done that one role on one Roger Corman movie for me to give you an entire movie franchise.
No. There were women who worked on Roger Corman movies too. They still didn't get their stuff up. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I know, but it's such a completely defunct argument of like, oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Was I a visual artist on a Roger Corman movie like James Cameron?
Exactly.
Like no. Not enough. No, not
and there
enough.
Were, you know, so there was like Joan Tewksbury who kind of got her start writing scripts, and she was told that was your way in. If you want to make movies, write scripts. So she wrote Nashville, for God's sake.
Nashville.
I mean,
just a little movie made in 1975 called Nashville.
No big deal, you know. I mean,
NBD, and only working with Robert Altman in maybe the greatest ensemble cast movie ever.
Of all time. Yeah, I think it's definitely in the mix, isn't it? She wrote Thieves Like Us, she wrote Eyes of Laura Mars. And when she finally went to direct and made her kind of feature debut, she did Old Boyfriends, which is based on a Paul Schrader script, because she didn't think she'd get her own script made. And then the film wasn't a success and she never got another chance. So the guys could fail and get another chance. The women...
failing out.
And even if they succeeded, they still didn't get another chance. Like it was a rigged game. So my chapter on the New Hollywood in the book is kind of a little bit heartbroken, if I'm honest, because all this talk of new ideas and new voices and opportunities and, you know, changing things up, it still only went to white men, really.
Yeah. It was almost like they could see the path forward. They could see this crazy youth and radical. And it's like, as soon as you make it a gender thing, they're like, oh no, that's too far. It's a bridge too far. It's ridiculous because when you look back at it, and I think it's the great Patton Oswalt bit, like every movie that you like is every movie made by a guy that you like is edited by a woman. Has a woman who's sitting there, like obviously the Marty and Thelma relationship is so important. Yeah. I think it's an interesting time because really, and I'm so looking forward to your book, it's the same thing of that, you know, tackling the Polly Platt series on You Must Remember This. It was just like, you know what? I've been a guy hyper obsessed with New Hollywood and different authorial voices. And that lens hadn't occurred to me how completely blinded I was. And then when I opened, I was like, this is ridiculous because this very small cohort that seemed to attract all the attention. And even in the context of this film, All the President's Men, Alan Pakula is not cool enough in the canon of New Hollywood to be one of the guys. He's not because he's an erudite, sophisticated, married dude who'd worked in as a production assistant all the way up to a producer and eventually a director. And he just wasn't cool enough. There's other filmmakers, like I think of a Phil Alden Robinson who made Sneakers and Field of Dreams. Again, a writer, television producer, very successful. No one talks about him because he's not like tyrannical.
He's not one of the cool kids. Yeah.
Not one of the cool kids. And you just, as soon as you're not one of the cool kids, it's funny, that tiered thing. And you go, wow, that lens, you know, it should be extending to all those different voices.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the sort of the idea of cool directors, and again, the auteur theory as a whole is something that, again, I sort of devote a chapter to in the book, because I think it's responsible for a lot of that imbalance. It's why we talk about Scorsese without talking about Schoonmaker in the same sentence all the time, you know, which we maybe kind of should. I don't dismiss the role of a director. It's incredibly important. It is formative in a film, but when we only ascribe the word auteur to a certain kind of person, we are not only diminishing the roles of everybody else involved in making the film, all these editors, all these script writers, all these people who might be women, might be people of color, might be anybody else. We're also lionizing a certain type of behavior, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about. Like, you know, you read Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, it's so much self-mythologizing, but that was happening as they were doing it. It's not like they're mythologizing it in retrospect, they were doing it at the time as well. They were portraying themselves as these great white hopes.
It's the greatest, like, you know how people say, a few people have said on this show when I introduce them, they're like, I need you to introduce me to women at bars, or I need you to introduce me in public. You know, it's just like, I feel like I get my own hype, man. And literally they were self-hyping.
Yeah.
Like, and the industry was self-hyping. And I think, I think the whole industry is looking, we're looking for those new voices and we're looking to hype them up. And just some people are better publicists. It's just one of those strange things where it happens and you go, when you reflect and you look at the entire eras. And my challenge with Auteur Theory 2 is, comparing the two movies that I've done the most extensive deep dives on, one is Heat, obviously, and then the second being All the President's Men. When I look at Heat, that movie feels like an auteurist thing because Michael Mann is such, is a mythologized figure. And maybe my podcast of 180 odd episodes probably helps that you in think? Some way. Yeah, possibly. But it's like he's a mythologized figure in working in Hollywood and in TV and in film. What has been kind of refreshing in the most interesting way is completely flipping that on its head and coming over and talking about presidents, because if you're talking about traditional auteurs, it's not is an easier definition. It's so much slipperier when you talk about presidents because you have incredible people like obviously Redford himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Crafting Goldman. The script. Yeah, Goldman, yep. Who is another huge figure. You got Pakula, you've got Gordy Willis. And the other massive ones, and this is just from doing the show and learning, I had a really phenomenal chat with one of Alan Pakula. Well, Alan Pakula's assistant producer, was a co-producer on the film.
Amazing.
Many moons ago now, it feels like, Mr. John Borston, who also wrote a film that Pakula directed later. And John and I talked about, what an incredible role that the editor, Robert L. Wolfe, had on this film.
Mm.
Because the original ending for All the President's Men, we're close enough to the ending. I feel like I can, we can spoil.
Spoilers.
Close enough to the end. The original ending of this film, it was originally conceived that Nixon flies down in that archival footage on a chopper down to deliver his sort of State of the Union speech in Congress. That's the beginning of the film. The final shots of the film were going to be Nixon resigned, jumping in a helicopter, leaving. So that there was this perfect, in that George Lucas, it rhymes, like that stupid thing you see in all the episode one behind the scenes.
It's a big journalist temptation as well, isn't it? Whatever your intro line is, that's where you echo in your finale,
Exactly. It's such that. But Robert L. Wolfe is an editor, worked in all of Peckinpah's films, and is a Republican figure. Like, he's a Republican guy. That's where his politics lied, and he worked on this movie. And he goes, it's too on the nose. It's kind of, they did cuts of it. And he's like, it doesn't play. You're ramming the point home. You've already sold it. And he was right. They cut the teletype ending of this movie because of his advice. And so when you hear about moments like that, you increasingly go, there's some personalities that kind of bring Auteur Theory to life in many ways. And they're almost like, you've done this, you work on different teams and there are editors and leaders. And I think anyone who's listening, if you've worked in like a team where you've had a great coach and a sporting team, and there's just something about certain personalities that can kind of drive who's the driving force of this? It's that person, whoever they are. Mm. And I think what is great is to just continue to pressure test that and stand against it. And even more so when you look at these like Titanic figures, when they go away, and to see where their failures are sometimes, or the things that don't quite work. And it's like, what was the, that's kind of what interests me in doing projects like this. Cause I'm like, what is the strange and interesting alchemy that created
between all
this,
these people,
between all the elements, all these massive Titanic personalities of actors and editors, or huge four different, on Heat, there were four editors on Heat because of the speed that they were cutting, and all those different editors are very accomplished editors in their own right. So you then look at their later careers and they've got really different and divergent editorial styles, and you're like, what the hell is this? And so it's really interesting, I think, but I'm again looking forward. This is a fun digression with you to go down. That's one question. got one question in.
Wow, we're doing well.
We're doing really well. Look, what I might do, Helen, is for everyone listening as well, guys, we're going to dial up. It is 2 hours and 11 minutes. Should be on your DVD or your Blu-ray. I've just been told by a boffin from the United States because All the President's Men is on HBO Max now. But there's apparently a 15-second ad that happens at the beginning of every HBO Max video. So if you can go to 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 15 seconds, you'll be where everyone else in the world is, but not us. We will be on the Blu-ray. Helen and I are going to watch this minute right now, leading into one of the greatest single monologues, I think, in American cinema. We're going to watch it and see the gravity of the words register in this moment. There's even a split diopter shot. Get excited, everyone. This is what people are watching this movie for. Helen and I are going to watch it together now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and we're going to unpack it for you.
Can't trust him.
Come on in.
We can't come in, sir.
Woodward says there's electronic surveillance.
Surveillance is doing it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm done. People's lives are in danger. Maybe even ours.
What happened to that justice source of yours?
Well, I guess I made the instructions too complicated because he thought I said hang up when I just said hang on.
Oh, Jesus.
The story is right. Haldeman was the fifth name to control that fund, and Sloan would have told the grand jury. Sloan wanted to tell the grand jury.
Why didn't he?
Because nobody asked him. Cover-up had little to do with the break-in. It was to protect covert operations. The covert activities involved the entire U.S. intelligence community.
Did Deep Throat say that people's lives are in danger?
Yes.
What else did he say?
He said everyone is involved.
Yes, sir, please.
Exactly.
We have an emergency. It's just, there's just all those tones. He has like this regally pissed off face. It's fantastic.
His face should be in a museum. It's honestly amazing.
It belongs in a museum. It's so good. And just, I can't get over all the different lighting decisions here, Helen. I mean, like when they choose to illuminate the faces, when they choose not to illuminate the faces, the thought that you are leading up to such a climactic moment and all of the, basically the faces of the three leads of the movie are largely, you know, shrouded in shadow for one of the final scenes. It's such a powerful little scene. And that line that hits, you know, it hits so hard at the end of this minute, but I just will never get over it every time I watch it because it just, it's dealt almost with like casual laissez-faire, but it just stings, which is, he said everyone is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is involved.
Everyone. And it's just, it's that that sort of intake a breath of, okay, all right, this is big, okay. It's really quite, it's quite almost film noir dialogue. It's so understated and so kind of hard bitten, you know, oh, I must have made the instructions too complicated. I said, hang on. He thought I said, hang up, whatever. Or sorry, other way around. But,
Love Bradley's reaction. Jesus Christ.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
He's just like, can you get like, if you're just doing a confirmation, why are we making someone dance around a bit? Like, he has to let that go. I love that. It's like, why did you make it that hard? Like, I hadn't thought of that during the minutes that we discussed. I'm like, why did he make it that hard? I always kind of loved him pacing it out. Anyway, such a hilarious thing. Please go on.
He's so good. Oh, no, that was the main point there. I mean, I think as well, the lighting, I mean, there's the very obvious and probably too obvious to be the case in this movie thing of them essentially walking from the darkness into the light, you know, because this is the moment of sort of enlightenment as far as Ben Bradley is concerned, like finally being convinced that this is not going to blow over, this is not going to dry up, that this like goes all the way to the top. I hate to be a cliche, but it does. And I think this is the bit where they finally truly convince him of that, you know, which is why it's so good, you know, and it's it's not that they say so much here. It's that they finally get rid of maybe the niggling doubts that remained after everything else, because they've hit so many roadblocks and it's been frustrating for him, for them, for everybody. And this is finally just kind of the last tiny little bits of information that convince him, okay, there's enough here. This is it, right? We're all in now.
It's, you point out something that, you know, a couple of guests of the show, and I remember it because he has a lovely way with words. A friend of mine, a great Bostonian film critic, Sean Burns, is like, this movie is just a whole bunch of people talking. Like, it's just that, just this conversation after conversation. It should not be nearly as riveting and entertaining as it is. Mm-hmm. It like has no right to be as revisitable as you know, sort of deep on every revisit as it is just with people having conversations. But I think you just hit the nail on something that I just really want to underscore, which is the way that they respond to his questions, because he does great follow-up questions to really make sure that they're on firm ground at every turn. The way he asks, and then the way that they immediately like have an answer for him without a single slip of hesitation, I think is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And exactly the point of like, they didn't ask him. They didn't, you know, we were right on Sloane. No one asked him about Haldeman. He wanted to flip on Haldeman. This justice guy, don't worry about that. That's ephemera. Doesn't matter. Sloane's right. Haldeman's the guy. Everyone's involved.
Yeah.
Like exactly. That's so good.
And it's an interesting contrast, isn't it, to the meeting way earlier in the film. You can tell me the exact minute, I'm sure, where they're discussing how to handle him as an editor, and oh, you made a mistake there. Yes. You know, this is an absolute contrast to that, because here there's no handling. There's just, here's the way it is. Boom, 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 done. You know, it's they're so sure of themselves now. There's no more games to be played. They just know what they have, and that's all they need to say.
And I think especially once in one of their very early interactions with Bradley, where he asks about Deep Throat, and they're like, do you trust him? Yes. He goes, I don't, you know, it's in like one of the first great scenes, you're like, you know, I can't do my reporter's work for them. I don't like to trust anybody, you know, like, and so, and right now, what did Deep Throat say? And he's like, he said, everyone is like, the fact that now the lines of dialogue between this source and the whole newsroom too, it's just so much more powerful, because he's like, now he's even talking. There's no more evasion even from Deep Throat. Deep Throat's like, everyone's involved. Everyone's in on this, and we're going to get them. And I guess that's the inference. I love what you said there. The noirish dialogue, or the very, very best noirish dialogue, feels like between every line is about four paragraphs, and they just don't need to say it. And it's, you know, the luxury of one of our other projects we did, which is Increment Vice, which was hosted by Travis Wood, who's a brilliant writer and a great podcaster. And so much of that is like how loaded every film noir line is because of all of that, all of the other stuff under the hood of every line. And I think you're so right here. It's like, now they don't need to say anything. Like, all the weight of everything that's been happening, it's right here. Like, this is where it is. Yeah. The final bits of the movie is just this interaction and that certainty. It's a great scene.
It's so good. And you're right about Bradley being an incredible editor, I think, as well. You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is not news to anyone that Ben Bradley is quite a good editor. But, you know, I think it's just brought really well to life in this scene. Like, he's pushing them on, what do you actually have? What do you actually know? Why do you know it? Where is it coming from?
Yeah.
But he's ultimately, you know, when he decides to support them, he goes all in. Like, that's it. All right, support you. So I just love that, because, you know, there is a big, big difference between good editors and bad editors. and you feel it in this scene. You really do.
By the time that people are listening to this episode, because people would have heard the scene just before this, the minute just before this was the great Liz Hannah and Josh Singer, who co-wrote The Post.
Oh, wow.
Josh is a screenwriter of Spotlight. Mm. And he talked about, in the lead up to the following scene, talking about Liev Schreiber's portrayal as Marty Baron. And he talks about that next scene. And I think that what we're about to see in the lead up to this moment, but what we're about to see is that great, you know, that Titanic monologue. But I think you're so right of like, There's an effortlessness. There's no who, what, where, why, when with Bradley here. He's just pushing, pressure testing you. And in the previous minute, Josh Singer, and you haven't had a chance to hear this yet, Helen, but Josh said when he did not watch all the President's Men when he wrote Spotlight. He did not watch the whole movie. Didn't want any part of it, watching it, because he didn't want to be influenced too much by it. And nor even with The Post. Didn't want to really revisit because they were doing something different. It was a different time. He said, but one scene he did watch for Spotlight was what we're about to watch. Basically the scene that you and I are talking about in that final monologue. They're talking about wanting to be able to know that once Robbie and obviously Mike and Sasha and Matt, the key Spotlight team, have all kind of broke, like they know the big story is going to break and they're about to see the fallout of this. He said he wanted to be able to, like, the high watermark is Marty Baron being able to give a pep talk speech to these guys who maybe, especially Robbie, who like, hey, we're all human. We can sometimes miss these things, but this is what it is. It's our time now. Like, we're scrambling around in the dark. And I think that Marty Baron scrambling around in the dark scene and him actually articulating those words of scrambling around in the dark, it makes no bones about it in the scene, in a very beautifully well-lit Boston Globe office scene, to say scrambling around in the dark. And yet right now in All the President's Men, these guys are literally scrambling around literally. In the dark. except for the moments that are of the blistering clarity of them going, yes, we know these facts and we are sure of them. And there's just one other real actorly technique here, which I've talked about a few times on the show so far, but these guys knew each other's lines. And the fact that Redford, like, it half comes out of Hoffman's mouth and then Redford hammers it home with the repetition of, like, this is a fact, you know, coming line after line and it being the same line and they're repeating from the different actors, I think is also a deeply underrated thing, because it's saying these guys are in sync.
In absolutely in sync. They know their shit. Yep.
And you don't have to do any other stuff. There's no exposition going, look, we're really on this to get, like, we're in this together. There's none of that. It's just like, these guys are saying the same words. They're thinking the same thoughts. They're in sync. It's just a beautiful little technique from an actor and script perspective.
It's just, and in terms of the pacing as well, it's perfect. But you're right. It's a world away from where we first saw them with Bernstein basically stealing Woodward's coffee and rewriting it when he wasn't looking. So, you know, and you know, there's always been that healthy kind of respect between them, because Woodward's response to that obviously was, I don't mind what you did, I just mind the way you did it. You know, fine. They respect each other's talents to that extent. But yet for them to have gone from that to this level of just, as you say, finishing each other's sentences, it's amazing.
And I also love, you know, we talk about good editors, like, you know, you're the editor at Large of Empire. Like, I work with some good editors, and I even have a text thread with the great editor, Garth Franklin, who runs Dark Horizons in Australia. Our WhatsApp text thread, I call it the Red Pen, because he's the editor, you know, and I'm like, go hard, boy, with that red pen, you know, because
seriously, I think
it, like, if you can have an editor who, like, will cut to the bone or something and just help you bust the fluff out of your own stuff, it's a really brilliant thing.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. I mean, I've had a great editor on my book. Obviously Terry at Empire, who's the editor in chief, is genuinely, I'm not just saying this because she's the boss, but she's genuinely an astonishing editor. Her magazine craft is off the charts good. I mean, I try to help other people with editing and stuff. Like, I don't have to anymore, which is amazing. Editor at large is one of those amazing
kinds. Editor at large, you know, it's good.
It's minister without portfolio. That's what it is. It's an amazing job because there's no actual duties attached. But I still sort of try to keep my hand in because it's so important. And, like, even when you're writing yourself, you've never written it until you've actually edited it at least once, but preferably about, let's be honest, 16 times.
Yeah.
Because that's where things get good. It really makes all the difference.
It's, you know, you can have a brilliant writing day. Mm. Like, you'd be like, oh my God, that's one of my biggest word count days.
I'm so good.
I'm good. And then you go, none of this is edited.
No.
And that editing is going to take a while. It's going to take a while to do. It's like the spitting out of the words before the craft, and then actually, like, doubling back and making sure that you've got it. And you can't always, and I'm sure you had, you know, such heavily researched things. It's like, you're going to scrutinize the living daylights out of it. You're going to learn your own mistakes. It's all that stuff. And it's just to have someone, and you know, in the preceding scenes, you know, in a recent episode that we talked about with James Urbaniak, you know, that the line "fuck him, we'll stand by the boys," like "fuck it, we'll stand by the boys," like that's just that's the person that's the person that you want in your corner in all of this, and it's such a and there's one thing that I hadn't really talked about was also just in just one of the lines in this scene, and I think right now we live in a world where we live in a post like NSA Snowden world where it's like everything's electronic surveillance. You know, you hear about like in-depth, you know, embedded journalists these days, like never carrying around an iPhone. They carry around their old flip phones because they don't have the same mechanisms of like tracking and recording. And one thing I never really realized until I was sort of prepping and scrutinizing the scene over and over again as part of this project is Bradley and all of the legacy of, you know, everything that had happened that is set with the post, like the Panama Papers, etc. He's familiar that there are government organizations and places out there that will electronically surveil you, and that it is completely plausible. And I just also love that from that beat of, oh, that's totally plausible. He doesn't go, oh, that's BS or whatever. He just goes, okay. And he just walks out into his front lawn because he wouldn't be surprised if people were surveilling him. That's just another touch in the scene. It's like, oh, Bradley thinks it's totally plausible for this to happen. That's just, it's a really great note because it's like, wow, in 1975, or in the setting of this, it's like 72, they're playing for 75 and the end is 74. It's like, oh, surveillance, you know, people would have never thought that people could be bugging their houses or until now, until this moment in time.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it is always interesting to me that this film came out so soon after the Watergate, like so quick. It's really ripped from the headline stuff in a way that, you know, even Spotlight was a much, much, much bigger gap. And it's that immediacy that kind of, I think, sells that moment. You know, they knew about, obviously, Cold War surveillance. They knew spies were doing that. That was fine. But by that point in the 70s, they were beginning to realize, oh, no shit, they're doing it at home as well.
All the Bond era had well and truly been rung in. And so, like, the concept of external spies, that's, but you're so right. It's like, oh, no, it's our government will do that to us too. You know, there's been enough protests for the Vietnam War so far for us to be cynical to believe and the civil rights movement and all that sort of stuff.
Trial of the Chicago 7 as well.
Same year. And look,
same era.
I would love to rack your brain. The only text that really contemporary text other than crappy TV movie of the week stuff that with examples that have been able to be dredged up on like Hallmark in the US, which we don't have access to in either the UK or Australia. The Social Network has repeatedly come up on the show as something that is made with such the same immediacy of like the events that were happening and legal battles happening at the same time. And that continues to resonate because really right now I still struggle. And, you know, the Trial of the Chicago Sevens, you know, which has had a pretty positive, but also a little bit mixed critical response. Like you said, it's decades after the fact.
Oh yeah.
Hindsight is 2020 when you've got 50 years to work with. So you really, you know, have the opportunity to craft something really brilliant. But like anytime anyone even mentions making a political scandal movie of like 2020, people are like, ugh, that's gross. Nah, I don't want to see it.
Oh,
it's
probably
going to be bad.
I mean, the reaction to that. That Michael Bay produced COVID thriller, the entire world was united with one voice just going, I don't want it. No. I mean, I do think you can probably be quick. I mean, this is astonishing. This is astonishingly quick, but there is probably, for some scandals, it is probably possible. Like there's probably ones where there's enough in the public domain pretty quickly. Like I think the Trump era, you could probably do quite a lot with that quite quickly because we know a lot of the shit that went down. It's just that nobody cared at the time because they weren't, you know, because they were watching Fox News or something. But I feel like there could be some quite quick films about the Trump era, whoever they're focused on, you know.
The only other one I know of, and this is again because I'm deeply biased on the whole Michael Mann side of things, is The Insider, which is made pretty hot on the heels of everything that happened with Big Tobacco. But again, it was kind of happening while it was off the reservation. Like Eric Roth, who wrote it, co-wrote it with Michael Mann, like, and Lowell Bergman, like it was all happening and they were communicating as friends and it's all happening, but it's still the difference is, Helen, and you would know this deeply from everything you've ever reviewed and watched, is like, there's one thing to make something, you know, right hot on the heels of an event and give it a cinematic profile and maybe tell an angle of the story that maybe no one has ever seen before or something like that, or have those aspirations. And then the next thing is actually doing it. And I think that when you look at, you know, The Social Network, it's like, oh, well, you kind of get like, you know, what Quentin Tarantino calls our generation's Kubrick, like Fincher, you get Aaron Sorkin, you get this incredible cast, you get this rich topic, you get, you know, you get all of the great teams that Fincher surrounds himself with, you get the great score by Reznor and Atticus Ross, you get people right at the time. It's just all those alchemical things are happening and they make that movie. And I look at Presidents and I'm like, if you take one element out of this mix, if you took a Redford out or a Goldman out or a, you know, a Hoffman out, it is not the same. It's not the same thing. It just doesn't, it doesn't work in the same way.
Yeah, that's entirely true. I do think, I mean, that is one of the things that makes this extraordinary. Not just the fact that it's an extraordinary film in its own right, but that given its immediacy, it still has such resonance. And that they were able to tell something this way and tell something so, forensically without losing any kind of universality, maybe, I don't know, but it's one of these cases, I guess, where being specific with your details actually makes a story feel more universal and not less. It's weird because, like, I mean, you have to pay so much attention to this film because they just, you know, just reel off these names, places, date, people, and you just, wait, who was that? And it's literally 10 minutes ago that they last mentioned him. Oh, of course. Yeah. All right.
But you know, it's on your third / potentially fourth viewing of this movie, like I completely agree. And that's what I just want to dispel for anyone who's, you know, if this is your first time listening to All the President's Minutes, welcome just to listen to Helen. Of course you're right to, but the multiple watchings of this movie absolutely help reinforce those details. And I think that one of the things that we've talked about is if you just trust, it's that weird thing. If you just trust that the people at the center of your movie actually know what they're doing, when they fleetingly run past a name, what they're really secretly telling you in their head, just from a craft perspective or a functional perspective, is you don't need to know this right now. You just need to know that they know that right now. Later on, when you remember it, or if you ever revisit it, or especially now, like unfathomable in 1975, they're thinking about, or 76, they're thinking about this movie like being played over and over again, let alone in the way that I'm doing it. But it's, I think great movies just hold up to that scrutiny. Like that's, but these long form projects, I just look at them and I deep dive on them. It's just like, there is no part of this movie that I've ever, even for a split second, been bored of. And the fact that they lay all of this incredible density into it, knowing that really not many people are going to get all this on the first time around, I also just kind of go, wow. Even further.
And to an extent, a lot of it doesn't matter in itself. It just matters that they know.
Yes.
It's a little bit, and this is not an obvious comparison, but it's a little bit like Tenet. So I decided when I watched Tenet the first time, I decided pretty early on, oh, it's nonsense. And I just treated it like it was nonsense. And I just let it wash over me. And I focused on what was happening, but I didn't try and analyze it as I was watching it the first time. And actually, weirdly, it made more sense to me than it did to my friend, who was desperately concentrating the entire way through and trying to get his head around everything that was happening. So I think that helped. But when I went back and watched it again, like, everything does make sense in to a degree, and everything, you know, does kind of tie together. So all that detail is there. It can be built in, but you don't have to focus on it for the movie to kind of entertain you. And I think it's a similar thing here, just with, you know, less time travel.
Way less time travel, way less neckerchiefs. Way less John David Washington, which I think that any movie could be significantly improved by him. But I would just say also, that's where some folks who don't like procedural movies or whatever, like, it is about, it is a barrier for entry. Like, if you come in and you just, like, something grabs you, you can watch it. I had the inverse response with Tenet, because I was just kind of like, I probably did the worst thing ever in Australia. And I said it a few times on the show, but it was like, in the weeks that the cinemas opened prior to Tenet, I went and saw some of my favorite films of all time with some of my favorite people. I saw Predator. I saw the beautiful 4K. I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey on 70 mil. I saw Jaws in their beautiful 4K release. And then I saw Heat, all with as packed the cinemas as Australia was allowing to have a number of people.
Wow.
And so I had like the best time at the cinema. I felt like I was back in church. It was amazing. And then I went and saw Tenet and I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah, it's fine. People are like, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. I think at the time I tweeted, Tenet is Chris Nolan's Black Hat, which a lot of people enjoyed. Because I'm just like, that's what, yeah, look, I watched Black Hat. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's not Heat. It's not maybe Inception, but it's fine. But no, I think you're so right. There is something about these more dense procedural movies just from the outset that if you can just surrender to its rhythm at the beginning, they're so much more easy to digest than if you're like, oh my God, who is Charles Coulson? Who is Charles? Like you're thinking about who is Charles. And sometimes then a name gets stuck in your head. Like, wait, Charles, who is that? Who did she work for? Was that, did she work for Coulson? And you will just get lost in the wash of trying to interrogate your own memory for a name. And it's like, forget that. But now it's like, it is all there. So, you know, those people have reassured me, like such as yourself, but I would, you know, no offense, but I'll listen to Helen, except for most randoms that are communicating with me via Twitter. But it's like, you know, good movies have the detail there if you're willing to revisit it. You know, little touches, little flurries, little things to keep looking out for. It's all there if it's really good. Helen, this has been such a thrill to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It was nice to have an excuse to go back and look at it again. And once again, wonder if I'm really a journalist at all, because honestly, it doesn't feel quite so important what we do.
I just, you know, if it's that stupid, if you won the lottery, you know, what would you do with my, and I'm like, I would just rebuild this exact set, like the exact office of the Washington Post in the 70s. I would create a magazine to rival Empire. I'm sorry, Empire. I'd just take Helen.
Wow.
I would just take every film journalist I knew. I would move them all, whether it be Australia, probably Australia now in COVID. No, actually New Zealand. We're all moving to New Zealand. I would create an office that looked exactly like that space. And I would just say, we just have to write stories, but we all have to act like the people in this movie. That's, and then just in the end of the day, like someone can worry about the magazine being printed. I just want all of us to dress in corduroy, write on typewriters, drink too much coffee, all of us smoke. That's my dream, Helen. That's like that. If there's one dream, we could just all together call each other, get those old school phones, like you plug your mobile phone into the side and do that. That's, you know, just sometimes I dream that we could one day, you know, recreate that. Because can you imagine? I mean, look, Empire is a great magazine. There are great publications that I've, and people from great movie publications I've spoken to. If any one of those publications could have an office like that, where all the writers could shoot the shit all day
and call
publicists from the same bank of phones and like help each other out. I'm like, that one would be the best. I don't care what anyone says. It would be the best. It would just like the best stuff would come out of it.
It would be amazing. Do you know what though? Like as well, and not to sound bitter, but you know, you look at Ben Bradley's house in this film and you think journalism's changed, hasn't it? I mean, I know he was at the very top of the profession even in those days, and the people at the very top of the profession, Washington Post, Marty Baron, of course, now, isn't he at the Washington Post, probably lives in a similar house. But at the same time, like it doesn't feel like that's what journalists look like now. And you know, so if I could win the lottery, I might just do that, just pay everybody a whole bunch more, and just we could all have nice houses.
Well, look, if the lottery dream comes true, I've got your email address and contact information. We're going to New Zealand. That's going to be the plan. But look, Helen, thank you so much. It's been great to chat to you.
Pleasure.
It's been great to talk to you about this movie and many other things. And it's a real treat. And thanks for being part of this experience. To have your name on the roster is awesome.
That's awesome. And thank you very much for having me. It's what an exciting project. And you're so close to the end now. Oh my God.
So close. Mere minutes, mere days for the people listening. If you're listening to this when this drops, we're days away.
Amazing.
Speaking of amazing, my incredible guest, Helen O'Hara. You can follow Helen at Helen L. O'Hara without the apostrophe on Twitter. You can listen to the Empire podcast, which you probably already subscribe to. And if you don't, do yourself a favor. One of the best podcasts about movies in the world. Women vs. Hollywood is out February 18, 2021. You can check out the link in Helen's bio for that. You can also find her writing as the editor at large, popping in and out at empireonline.com or writing, reading the physical magazine if you can get a copy of that for those physical media nuts out there. I've been your host, Blake Howard. One Blake Minute is where you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. OneHeatMinute.com is where you can find out about the show. Mail at OneHeatMinute is where you can email us. Please subscribe, rate, review, and if you want to follow what's happening on all the President's Minutes, just for the final few episodes, at ATPM Pod for the final bits. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode tomorrow for one of the most anticipated moments of the entire film.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.